two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
Well, thanks, Rebecca, and welcome to yet another episode of Words and Movies. This is episode 20, and I am your co-host, Claude Call.
And I am your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. And on this episode, we're continuing sort of the theme from our previous episode where we looked at comedies about war. Now we're covering comedies about the Great Depression. The two movies that we're going to be covering this time, Sullivan's Travels, written and directed by Preston Sturges, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, written and directed by the Coen brothers, Ethan and Joel, are both set during the Great Depression. In addition to that, both of them are influenced or inspired, perhaps is the better word, by works of classic literature. Sullivan's Travels takes its title and perhaps its structure from Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, while Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is inspired by Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey. How much it was inspired is something we'll discuss when we get to that movie. And both movies also feature protagonists who, as it turns out, are not as smart or as clever as they think they are. And there's one other connection that both movies share, but Claude's going to reveal that when he gives us the plot description for Sullivan's Travels.
Yeah, in fact, it comes up in the second sentence of my plot description here. So Joel McRae is John L. Sullivan, a film director who makes popular films that have earned him a lot of money, but he is starting to feel dissatisfied with the work he's been doing, and he decides that he wants to make something a little more relevant with a message to it. He wants his next movie to be an examination of the plight of the poor based on a book called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
But with a little sex in it.
But with a little sex in it. Well, his studio boss, Mr. LeBrand, who is played by Robert Warwick, yes, does want a little bit of sex in it. But basically, he wants to talk him out of the project altogether. And when one of LeBrand's assistants, a man named Casales, who is played by Franklin Pangborn, suggests that Sullivan would have trouble making the picture because he can't relate to the downtrodden, Sullivan gets the idea to become one with the poor. So he's going to travel for a while as a tramp so that he can genuinely understand the problems that the poor have to deal with. Now, Sullivan, with the help of his butler and his valet, dresses himself down to look like a hobo and prepares to hit the road. But LeBrand and Casales have something else in mind. They see this adventure as a huge publicity opportunity, and they insist on having several of his staff follow him in this modded-out bus, complete with an office space, full bathroom and kitchen, and who knows what else. Sullivan protests, but he doesn't have much choice in the matter. He gets out on the road, but when there's a bus following you at walking speed, well, you're not really getting the full hobo experience. He flags down a kid, and I'm talking about a literal kid, in a tricked-out car known as a whippet tank, and we get a high-speed chase that involves a lot of physical comedy as the entourage is thrown about the bus and generally makes a mess of things. When it's all over, Sullivan cuts a deal with the crew to let him go on his own to Las Vegas, and he'll meet them there. He eventually catches a ride in a truck, but unfortunately, it takes him back to Hollywood. Sullivan goes into a diner, still carrying the one dime he had taken with him, and orders coffee and a donut. He meets up with a young actress played by Veronica Lake and who has no name in the film. She's credited as the girl, probably only because a police officer refers to her that way in one scene, but I have another theory that we can talk about later. The girl, thinking that he's just some busted flat guy, buys him a ham and eggs breakfast, and she tells him that she's giving up on acting and preparing to go back home, presumably on the East Coast. Sullivan doesn't reveal himself, but he does manage to retrieve his car from his estate, and he gives her a ride. Unfortunately, the servants don't know he has his own car, and they report it stolen, so the pair is apprehended by the cops, and once again, he finds himself back in Los Angeles until they can get the mix-up straightened out. At this point, the girl knows that he's really John L. Sullivan, the famous movie director, and she shoves him into his swimming pool for lying to her. That said, when he decides to take another crack at going out, She insists on going with him, disguised as a boy. This time around, the experiment is a little bit more successful. We get a great montage of scenes where they go to a shanty town, they eat in a soup kitchen, they sleep in a homeless shelter. And while they're in the shelter, somebody steals Sullivan's nice shoes, leaving behind their own badly worn ones. From time to time, we also see the publicity department photographing him during these activities. Sullivan finally decides he's seen enough and he returns home. Now, the studio sees it as a huge success. The girl wants to remain with him, but Sullivan reveals to her that he is married to somebody else, strictly as a tax dodge that is not working out in his favor in any way, and probably because his wife is having an affair with his business manager. Sullivan decides he's going to thank those homeless from whom he learned so much by handing out $5 bills. But down near a train station, he is ambushed and stuffed into a boxcar by the same guy who stole his shoes. The assailant takes whatever his money is left, and he watches the train leave the station. Now, while walking through the rail yard counting the money, he gets hit by a train and he's killed, but he's so badly mangled that nobody can identify the body. Meanwhile, Sullivan's people are looking everywhere for him, including checking the local hospitals. And finally, one associate calls from the morgue, and when they find an ID card that Sullivan's valet had hidden in the shoes, they identify the body as Sullivan's and declare him dead. Sullivan, in the meantime, wakes up in another city, still hurting and dazed from being hit in the head. He's not sure who he is or how he got there. He gets off the train in the rail yard, which is a hobo faux pas, because the unwritten rule is that the rail workers won't hassle you if you stay outside the yard. He's immediately confronted by a railroad employee, and a scuffle ensues, during which a still dazed Sullivan picks up a rock and hits him with it. So he's arrested as a John Doe, or more accurately, a Richard Roe, and I have a theory about that too. And he is sentenced to 6 years in a labor camp. Little by little, he begins to get his memory back, but he's still pretty bitter that nobody will listen to him except for the trustee, who is played by Jimmy Conlon. The labor camp gets the opportunity to go to a local church to see a movie, and Sullivan is puzzled at first to see the other men laughing at the Disney cartoon, but then he finds himself laughing along with them. Sullivan can't convince anyone at the prison camp that he is who he is, but he gets the idea to confess to his own murder so that he'll get his picture in the newspaper. When his photo lands on the front page, the girl recognizes him, and she shows the newspaper to LeBrand. Sullivan is eventually released from the labor camp, but it turns out that while he was away, his quote-unquote widow had already married his business partner. That makes her a bigamist, so now she has to divorce him or go to jail. LeBrand is convinced that the story is worthy, and he tells Sullivan that he can make O Brother, Where Art Thou, but Sullivan has changed his mind because he realized in the church that the comedies he's been making make a greater contribution to society than he originally imagined. As he puts it in his last line, "There's a lot to be said for making people laugh. Did you know that it's all some people have? It isn't much, but it's better than nothing in this cockeyed caravan."
Okay, now one correction I have to make before we go any further. The guy who is with LeBrand, who tells Sullivan that he doesn't know anything about being poor, is another executive who is LeBrand's partner, Mr. Hadrian, and he's played by Porter Hall. Mr. Casalsis, Franklin Pangborn's character, is one of the many flunkies, I guess, who work under LeBrand and under Hadrian. But Hadrian is the one who says that to Sullivan. Now, we should talk a little about Preston Sturges, because while Orson Welles may have been the most important name to emerge from the 1940s, as far as directors go, anyway, it is my contention that during the decade of the 40s, Preston Sturges was the best filmmaker working in Hollywood at the time. He started out as a screenwriter working in the 30s. He put his name on, among other things, the original version of Imitation of Life. And he also wrote a film that was sort of a precursor to Citizen Kane, The Power and the Glory, which the studio executive of the studio that produced the movie claimed was the best script he had ever read at the time. And he wrote a couple other very good movies from the late 30s and early 40s that Mitchell Leeson directed, Easy Living and Remember the Night. But he, Sturges, like many a writer, screenwriter that is, toiling away in Hollywood, was dissatisfied with what directors and studios were doing to his movies. So while there were directors like Charlie Chaplin who wrote their own scripts, and then there were screenwriters like Ben Hecht who occasionally got to direct a script of theirs, but in Hecht's case, he had to share directing credit on one of his movies. Sturges was the first screenwriter who worked his way up who became a director of one of his own scripts, paving the way for people like John Huston and Billy Wilder, who also started out as writers before they became directors. And Sullivan's Travels was the fourth film in his terrific run as a director, which started out with The Great McGinty, which he sold the script for to Paramount for $1 on condition that they'd let him direct it. Christmas in July, and the first classic movie, I would say, that he wrote and directed, The Lady Eve. So this was right when his stock was still pretty high.
Yeah, and this was actually, it was still pretty early in his directing career. I mean, he didn't have a ton of films the way some other, you know, directors did. I mean, he has a lot of writing credits, but he, as far as I remember, he didn't, I don't know, like maybe a dozen, a little bit more, something like that, as far as films. And this was kind of early in that run, if I remember correctly.
Yes, well, he did flame out, unfortunately. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the end of talking about the movie. But one thing that, you know, I also want to mention about Sturges, as we mentioned when we talked about Stage Door, one of the pleasures of watching movies from the studio era is watching a great collection of character actors that show up in those movies. And they showed up in pretty much most of the movies that came out during that time. But no director used them more and used more of them in his movies than Sturges did, with the possible exceptions of Frank Capra and John Ford, who also had a large cast of people that they put in all of their films. But the difference between Sturges and someone like Capra or Ford is that when Capra and Ford cast their stock players in a movie, generally speaking, they tended to play the same type of roles in their movies. You know, like, for example, Samuel S. Hines plays a father figure in You Can't Take It With You, and he also played the father in It's a Wonderful Life. And Jane Darwell, who played Maude Jode in The Grapes of Wrath, which, by the way, the novel O Brother, Where Art Thou in Sullivan's Travels is probably inspired somewhat by Grapes of Wrath. But she also played mother figures in other Ford films. But Sturges liked to mix things up a bit when it came to his cast. I mean, there are people who play similar roles in his movies. Like, for example, Robert Grieg plays one of the butlers that Sullivan has, and he played a butler in Sturges' previous film, The Lady Eve. But in The Lady Eve, Eric Blore played a con artist, whereas here he plays the other butler.
He's the valet,
to
yeah.
Sullivan. Yeah, he's the valet. And Porter Hall, in this movie, as I said, he plays a studio executive who is blunt but generally a good guy because he does want what's best for Sullivan. And then in The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, which is a movie we'll be talking about in the future episode, he plays Justice of the Peace, a guy who's in charge of marrying people if they're willing to pay over a couple bucks. And he's sort of an impatient guy in that movie. And then there's also Jimmy Conlon, who, as Claude mentioned, is a convict here, and in Miracle of Morgan's Creek, he plays one of the members of the city council. And then you have probably the character actor most identified with Sturges, William Demarest, who here has a small role as a publicity flack for the studio. But in The Great McGinty, he plays a crooked politician. And in The Lady Eve, he actually plays the valet to Henry Fonda's character and gets one of the most memorable closing lines in movies, which I'm not going to spoil if you haven't seen The Lady Eve. So Sturges like to mix it up with his stock company of actors, and he did it very well.
Yeah, he did. And actually, I wanted to mention that the guy who played the trustee, I was, as I'm watching this and I'm looking, I was like, boy, he looks familiar. Boy, he sounds familiar. And I wasn't necessarily connecting him to older movies. Is like it was kind of funny because I originally thought it was like, Could this be William Buell in a much younger role, like just kind of made up to look older? I was like, no, nah, I had to check it out. The dates didn't look right, and it didn't match up. And so I had to go back and look it up. It was like that strong of an association for me. And for those of you who don't know, William Buell is probably best known. He was the character Johnny in the short-lived TV series Police Squad. He was the shoeshine guy who was always slipping people information. And it was like, man, the sound's the same and he looks the same, just like, you know, a slightly different version. And I really had to look and discover, oh, Jimmy Conlon. Okay, different guy. That struck me as kind of funny, just that they were almost like spiritual cousins in the way they spoke and the way they looked.
Well, it's possible since the men who created Police Squad were all classic movie fans that's the type that they were going for when they cast Buell as the shoeshine guy. Now, one other thing I want to mention about Sturges' style before we get into particulars of the movie. Breaking the fourth wall, for those who don't know what that term is, when you're watching a play on stage or watching a movie in the theater, well, when you used to be able to watch a movie in the theater, let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that there were three walls on the stage or in the movies. There's stage left, stage right, and then the back. And then the fourth wall is the invisible wall that separates the movie or the play from the audience. And generally speaking, most plays and most movies tend to pretend that fourth wall is invisible and doesn't exist. Now, there were, even back then, some movies that would occasionally break the fourth wall, where someone would, you know, speak out of character as if they were talking to the audience. In our previous episode, we talked about Duck Soup, and the Marx Brothers would occasionally do break the fourth wall, or at least Groucho would. In the movie before Duck Soup, Horse Feathers, when Chico's playing the piano, Groucho says to the audience, "I have to stay here, but there's no reason why you can't go outside until this is all over."
Right.
Now, Sturges didn't break the fourth wall exactly, but he sort of bent it a little. You know, he'd indulge in what we might call in these days meta filmmaking, where, you know, he acknowledges that this is sort of a movie, even though no one actually speaks to the audience about it. The prime example, of course, is when Sullivan and the girl are arrested for stealing Sullivan's car, and the policeman at the Beverly Hills station asks Sullivan, what's the girl have to do with any of this? And Sullivan says, there's a girl in every picture. What's the matter? Don't you go to the movies? And then at some point also, Sullivan or someone else says, this needs a plot twist at some point.
Yeah, Sullivan says that. He says it to the trustee.
Right. Oh, that's right. When he's trying to think of how to get out of prison.
Right.
So again, you know, he is sort of bending the fourth wall a bit. It's not taken to as much of an extreme as he did in his next movie, The Palm Beach Story, which basically was, let's take the romantic comedy and see how much we can stretch it before it breaks and throw in every ridiculous twist that you can think of because it's a movie, without really acknowledging that it's a movie, but you know and I know that it's a movie.
Right. And it almost frames itself along the lines of this is a guy who lives and works in Hollywood, and therefore this is the way a guy who lives and works in Hollywood is going to think. So some people are going to look upon it as a kind of meta humor, and other people are just going to be, well, this is just the way the character is going to behave regardless.
Right, which is also a situation in another movie we covered earlier, All About Eve, mm-hmm. which is set in the world of the theater. So, of course, people are going to talk like they're in the theater. Now, Sullivan's Travels was an important film for Sturges in another respect, in that this was the first of three movies that he did with Joel McRae in the lead. After this was The Palm Beach Story, which, again, is one of his classics. And then the third one was The Great Moment, which, ironically, is the very type of movie that Sturges was sort of preaching against here in this movie. It is a biopic and a quote-unquote important movie, even though Sturges does try to leaven things with comedy. It's about the guy who invented an anesthetic for dentists when they work on people's cavities or any other oral surgery that they have to attempt. And it is the one movie that Sturges did while at Paramount that was pretty much hacked to bits by the studio. So it's not really fair to judge the film because what we see is only an inkling of what it might have been. But it is definitely the weakest film that Sturges did. But
yeah, it's one of those films that kind of like the ones we did last time around with Catch 22 and
Duck Soup.
Duck Soup, thank you. Just had a blank moment there. Is that neither of them were especially well received at first. And then upon a reappraisal, they kind of grew in stature. And I think Sullivan's Travels kind of like suffered the same sort of fate.
Yeah, no, I mean, it definitely was not his most popular film at Paramount. That may be why when a new studio executive, Buddy De Silva, took over in charge of head of production at Paramount, he and Sturges pretty much clashed regularly. But Sullivan's Travels has become acclaimed over the years, as you said. Jerry Seinfeld, for one, picks it as his favorite movie as to what it's about, although it's not his favorite movie to watch all the time. Now, McRae found Sturges a great person to work with, one of his favorite directors to work with, the others being George Stevens and Gregory LaCava, who, as we mentioned before, was the director of Stage Door. And that he, McRae, that is, and Sturges would spend a lot of time talking about a particular scene and how to do it. And McRae, although later in his career, would turn away from the comedies that he made during that time and work exclusively in Westerns, always cherished working with Sturges on these comedies, even though at first glance he doesn't seem to be a comic actor because he seems to be so dour. But in earlier movies, he did show a more charming personality, and he does have very good comic timing here, especially, or not, maybe not especially, but particularly in the scene where all of the inmates are in the church watching the Disney short, which, by the way, is called Playful Pluto. And originally, Sturges wanted a Charlie Chaplin short in there, but Chaplin refused to give it to him. And you can see Sullivan looking around at the other inmates, deciding whether he not he should laugh. And then he laughs, and then he stops, and then he laughs again once you can see him decide, okay, I am going to enjoy myself because this is really funny.
Yeah, and in fact, he has to check himself, and he turns to the, I think he's sitting next to the trustee, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And asks, am I laughing? And the trustee just points him back up to, you know, go look at the movie. And that's when he really kind of gives in and allows himself to enjoy the film, which is, by the way, that's a great scene. The whole scene beginning to end is really, really good. From the moment we first see the church and we go inside, and you got the organist and the preacher there who is talking about what's going to be happening and how this is something that they've established, that it's something they do on a fairly regular basis. And so nobody gives them a hassle as far as like moving out of the first few pews. And they're very gracious to the inmates, and just the way the whole thing feels. It was a terrific scene. It really was.
Right. And we should mention here, as much as I love Sturges as a filmmaker, both a writer and director, I have to admit, when it comes to portraying African-American characters, he's not always the best at it. You know, there's a servant character to the studio executives earlier in the movie who is pretty much a stereotype. Not quite as bad as the one he had in one of the films he wrote, Remember the Night, or the train porter in the Palm Beach Story, but not great. Yeah. The church sequence is one of the few times where, you know, it is a familiar stereotype that he's showing with the preacher, but at least it's a more dignified one. And apparently one of the executives at the NAACP actually praised the movie for that, or at least sent a letter to Sturges praising him for that. Mm-hmm. Now, we should also talk about the character of the girl. Although Sturges worked with, as I said, a lot of actors over and over, including leading men. You know, after McRae, he did two movies with Eddie Bracken. He didn't work with a lot of the same actresses over and over again, with one important exception, Bessie Howard, I believe is her name. She's the one who, Esther Howard, excuse me. She's shows up as a madam in The Great McGinty, and she plays the mayor's wife in Hail the Conquering Hero, and she's also the wife of the Justice of the Peace in Miracle of Morgan's Creek. And here she plays the landlady of a house that Sullivan stays at early on, who tries to seduce him, and then he runs out on. But his lead actresses, he tended not to work with more than once. And Veronica Lake was no exception. Now, she did not have the greatest range, but what she did, I think she did pretty well. And while in his book, Romantic Comedy in Hollywood, James Harvey, who devotes pretty much the last third of the book to Sturges, and whom I normally agree with, says that of all of the lead actresses that Sturges worked with in his movies, he found Lake to be the weakest and also the character to be the weakest. And I would have to disagree. I think Lake carries herself well. Especially if you know that she was working while she was pregnant for several months, and yet, thanks to some clever costuming and camera angles, you don't really see that much. But also, you know, I think she and McCrae banter well. I think she plays his link to the world and the fact that she's a lot more street smart than he is. And I think that she delivers Sturges' dialogue very well. Like, for example, when she imagines herself talking to a fictional executive whom she calls Mr. Smearcase. That's very interesting, Mr. Smearcase. Why, Mr. Smearcase? You're getting a little familiar here, or words to that effect. So right.
And then she starts referring to Sullivan as Mr. Smearcase. And it's just funny because Smearcase is cottage cheese.
Yes.
And it's actually here in Baltimore, it's actually a popular kind of cake, Smearcase cake. And I don't know if they use cottage cheese specifically, because it can be used as a generic word for like spreadable type cheeses as well. So it might not be cottage cheese that they're putting in those cakes. I just remember my late father-in-law loved the stuff. But I actually have to agree a little bit. I think she was kind of limited in this role. Yes, there was a little bit of good back and forth between her and McCrae, but I think part of that is because it was a little bit more rapid fire, and so she just didn't get enough room to be weak about it. I think that there were a couple of times when she just couldn't carry it off, It's kind of funny, because I didn't learn about the pregnancy thing until after I had seen the film for the first time. And so I was watching a little bit more closely this time around when rewatching it for this. And so I was like, okay, where are they using – because they did have a body double for some shots. I'm like, where are they using the body double and where are they not? And there is one scene – oddly enough, the one scene where it really appeared to me like, wow, yeah, she is kind of pregnant there going on is – when she's dressed as a man and she's wearing this outfit. And I'm like, oh yeah, something's going on there. Her belly is clearly more prominent here than in all those times when she's dressed as a woman. And even in the one scene where she is in the shower, and I mean, everything's kind of obscured by steam and the shower curtain and whatever else, but you do not necessarily see a pregnant form through the shower curtain. And remember, right. I'm not watching for prurient reasons at this point. I'm like staring, just I'm looking for the hints of the pregnancy at that point.
Right. And then, of course, there is the body double in the scene that Sturges himself actually appears in. It's near the end when she finds out that Sullivan is alive and she runs through the studio to tell LeBrand and Hadrian. Sturges appears as the director of the picture that she's working on. But,
yeah,
you know,
and that's all long shots and, you know, sure.
Yeah, no. As we mentioned in the previous episode, when we were talking about Catch-22, Sturges like to use a lot of long shots. As a matter of fact, John Seitz.
I'm sorry. When I say long shot, I meant from a distance, not long. Long takes. Okay.
Okay, but he did like to use a lot of long takes. As a matter of fact, John Seitz, who was the cinematographer of the film, mentioned later on that he saw Sturges setting up the camera here, and he pretty much dared Sturges to film the scene that he was going to film in one take. And Sturges took him up on it, and they managed to film 10 pages of dialogue in about 4.5 minutes.
Yeah, that was actually one of the opening scenes of the film is when Sullivan is having the discussion with the studio people. So it would be, I guess, what you call the second scene of the film after we've seen the movie with Labor and
Capital,
yeah, having the fight on top of the train. And what's interesting about that is, I don't know if anybody caught this, is that's a flip shot. So because the numbers on the train are backward. And I wonder if that was also part of Sullivan's big statement, is like everything is backwards to begin with. But yes, that was the scene which was done in one continuous take. And I did notice that. But again, it was something I learned later on was part of a dare.
Right. Now, to me, this movie is somewhat similar after watching it again. It reminded me a little of New York, New York, directed by Martin Scorsese, in that both movies are attempting to fully embrace the genre that they're in, but at the same time, they try to nudge reality up to it in a way that wasn't necessarily done in those types of genre films at the time that they were made. And that's part of how the movie, I think, is influenced by Gulliver's travels, and that, you know, you have these four times that he's traveling to see the homeless. The first two times, of course, end up in complete failures. The third time, when he and the girl are wandering around and staying in shelters and sleeping inside boxcars of trains, where he actually does get a taste of reality in a way that he hadn't quite pictured it before. And then the final time, when he gets knocked out, has temporary amnesia, and then gets sentenced to a chain gang, which is a whole sort of reality that he never imagined he'd have to face. So this is showing for him the cost of wanting to find out what poverty is really like. And New York, New York sort of does the same thing. That's a movie I hope we'll be talking about sometime in the future. But both of them, as I said, they're trying to show the reality that these types of genre movies didn't always acknowledge, or if they did, it was only in a dialogue reference here, or maybe a visual moment there.
Yeah, they kind of acknowledge where they are, and at the same time, they're going to mock it just a little bit. And I think that's why some people view this film as somehow satirical, and I never quite got that feel for it. Yes, there's meta humor going on, and yeah, it's kind of poking fun at the movie industry, but I never really viewed this as a form of satire. That particular genre just never really struck me as far as this film was concerned. We've mentioned a couple of times the scenes where Sullivan and the girl are going down and, you know, seeing the shanty town and eating in the soup kitchen. And we should mention once again that this is just a montage. There is no dialogue. There's no real audio. It's just the music, a musical soundtrack of him walking through the shanty town and seeing the people that are there and going to what is presumably the Salvation Army, given the band that you hear, and you can actually see them in the corner of the screen as you're watching them and listening to them play. and the signs up on the wall, like, have you written to your mother, and, you know, stuff like that. And being in the shelter for the night and losing his shoes, that's like several minutes of footage where you are not getting any dialogue and you still manage to know exactly what is going on. You've got that scene, and then the other scene near the end where once the girl identifies the photograph, okay, from there, almost all the way actually up to the point where we finally see Sullivan out of jail, again, is all music, all soundtrack music, no dialogue, no local audio, no nothing like that. And again, we know exactly what people are saying. We know exactly what the reactions are. We know exactly what's happening. And, you know, I think both of them worked really well. And this ties into a theory I have as far as why the girl is just called the girl, okay, And it also happens to several characters. I mean, it's not just her. There are a lot of characters in this film who have no name. The doctor doesn't have a name. The cameraman doesn't have a name. There's the guy who runs the radio telephone, the shortwave thing that they're using to communicate with the studio. He has no name. The trustee has no name. The guy running the labor camp doesn't have a name other than the Mister. And I think between that and the fact that what you're getting is a lot of music and a lot of action and no dialogue is a little bit of a throwback to silent era films, where you're going to get that sort of thing. If you look, especially, I'm thinking about like Chaplin and Harold Lloyd, you know, there were a lot of times when you would get the cast right up front and it was like Howard Lloyd as the boy and, you know, so-and-so as the girl and so-and-so as the father and, you know, that kind of thing. So people are just identified by their titles rather than any kind of a name. And you know, that was the thing that struck me. I think this is a little bit of homage to that era, which was still pretty recent in everybody's head at that point.
Well, you know, Sturges has been a fan of silent movies. As I said, he wanted a Chaplin short to be shown at the church scene instead of what we got, which was the Disney short. And almost all of his comedies that he directed not only feature a lot of verbal comedy, but they also feature a lot of physical comedy, including pratfalls, such as when Veronica Lake starts to run, she's dragging her microphone and trips someone as she's running. And the music that you mentioned is a style that's called Mickey Mousing, which is when the music exactly mimics the action that's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's called Mickey Mousing, of course, because it was first done at Disney in his animated shorts. Now, you mentioned that this is that some people view this as a satire. There are people who like this the least of Sturges' films from that time because they think, ironically, that he's going too far the other way and trying to make a movie that is supposed to be an attack on those who feel that comedy needs to be important in order to be valuable. You know, there's a couple of snide references to Capra when, ironically, this is probably Sturges at his most Capra-esque. Yeah. And also, by the way, the guy who plays the Mister, I think his name is Al Bridge or Alan Bridge, as he's billed in the credits. He went on to appear in a Capra movie, It's a Wonderful Life. And William Demarest had also appeared in a Capra movie a couple of years earlier, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But anyway, there are those who think that this is Sturges' weakest film because of that. Now, I happen to be a fan of Capra, so I can understand where they're coming from, but at the same time, you know, I'm one of those people who feel that once you place limitations on a genre, you're basically placing limitations on it being art. So if someone wants to fool around with it a little bit, then I say that's fine. And yes, it does become a little heavy-handed at times, but overall, while this is not my favorite of Sturges' films, I do quite like it.
Well, it does take that dark turn when he gets hit with the head and run, you know, stuffed into the train. And the whole tone of the film changes for a little while. But you're mentioning Capra. That brings me to another one of my theories I wanted to bring up. And you know, him being checked in or rather convicted as a Richard Roe. Rather than a John Doe, well, Meet John Doe was also in theaters around the same time. So I get the feeling that they kind of wanted to avoid making a reference to a Capra movie, having already made a reference to Capra himself.
That's entirely possible. Now, one other filmmaker that I want to mention before we wrap this up that Sturges wanted to pay tribute to was Ernst Lubitsch. He actually wanted to dedicate the film to Lubitsch because Lubitsch at one time was the head of Paramount, and he was a filmmaker, more importantly, whom Sturges admired very much. But the folks at Paramount did not want any dedication in there to a particular filmmaker, and I guess not to Lubitsch either. So instead, what Sturges has is Sullivan promising the girl that he'd send a letter to Lubitsch on her behalf to get her work in one of Lubitsch's pictures. Ironically, sadly, Lubitsch would not make many movies after Sullivan's Travels was released. I think he made two of his best ones after that, To Be or Not to Be and Heaven Can Wait, but died not long after making those movies. But at any rate, that's why there's the whole subplot about the girl wanting to meet Lubitsch and Sullivan promising to put in a reference to him on her behalf.
See that? If they had just let him do the dedication, there would have been like 118 Lubitsch shout-outs throughout the course of the film.
Yeah, well, okay, so anything else you want to mention before we wrap this up?
Just real quick, this is a fun film. It really is to watch and to hang back and enjoy. And if you... I would say go in and watch it and just kind of dig it the first time around. Then go back and watch it a second time because there's a lot of like funky little Easter eggs in the film that you can look for. And this is in an era where Easter eggs weren't much of a thing. But I'll bring up two for you, and you can find any others on your own. One is the scene in the shantytown as they are walking through, and there is a sign on one of these shacks that reads "For Sale FHA Terms," which I thought was pretty funny. And the other thing is the author of the book, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, is named Sinclair Beckstein, which could be a reference to Upton Sinclair, who was very much into reform at that point. It could be Sinclair Lewis and probably also little John Steinbeck going on there.
As a matter of fact, it was meant as an amalgam of their names, at least according to IMDb.
Uh-huh.
So we're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is. Welcome back to part two of our episode.
Yes, and now we're going to get right to it. Claude's going to give us the plot description for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes, indeed. And we open up with a scene involving a chain gang breaking rocks somewhere in 1937 Mississippi, working in time with the song Poe Lazarus. Three convicts managed to get away from the rest of the gang, though we don't know how. They are Ulysses Everett McGill, played by George Clooney, Delmar O'Donnell, played by Tim Blake Nelson, and Pete Hogwallop, portrayed by John Turturro. Everett, as he's generally called throughout the film, has talked them into going with him to retrieve a cache of money he told them he buried, but there's a time crunch involved because the area is going to be flooded to create an artificial lake. We're talking about money in the neighborhood of $1.2 million, and even in the 21st century, that's a pretty respectable neighborhood, so they have agreed to go with him. As they cross a train track, they encounter a blind man pumping a handcar on the railway, and they hitch a ride with him. The blind man tells them that they will find a fortune, but not the one they seek. The trio's first stop is at the house of Pete's cousin Wash, short for Washington. They get free of their chains and they're asleep in the barn when Sheriff Cooley, played by Daniel Von Bargen, shows up. It turns out that Wash turned them in so he could get the bounty money. Wash's son and a little dumb luck help them to escape from Cooley, but they also take Wash's car and they abandon the boy a few miles from home. They pick up a young African-American man named Tommy Johnson. Tommy says he was standing at the desolate intersection where they found him because he had met with the devil the night before so that he could sell his soul in exchange for the ability to play his guitar. Tommy is headed toward a radio station so he can earn some money playing music for the blind station owner who is seeking old-timey material he can record and play for his listeners. He got the idea from a show that the governor does on the station where he pitches his political opinions and brings in musicians to play music in between. The music keeps people listening, so the station owner, played by Stephen Root, is encouraged to play the music when the governor's show isn't on. The four boys introduce themselves as the Soggy Bottom Boys and record the song Man of Constant Sorrow. That night, the police find the car and Tommy takes off for parts unknown, and the three manage to get away. As they're walking down a road, they hear singing, so they follow the sound to find three women singing Didn't Leave Nobody But the Baby. They give the men corn liquor until all three of them pass out. Delmar and Everett wake up, but only Pete's clothes are there. Pete appears to be gone, but there is a frog, or a toad rather, in his clothes. Delmar is convinced that the women were sirens and that they turned Pete into a toad for his sins. He scoops up the toad and they stash it in a shoebox, hoping to find a way to turn it back into Pete. They get a ride from Babyface Nelson, played by Michael Badalucco, who insists on being called George Nelson rather than Babyface, and they inadvertently help him to rob a bank. Incidentally, Babyface Nelson did, in fact, hate being called Babyface. Nobody did that to his face, but also in real life, he was dead by this point. At any rate, Nelson goes into a deep depression after the bank robbery, and he gives them the loot. Now they're flush with cash, so they take a meal in a restaurant where they meet with Big Dan Teague, a one-eyed Bible salesman who invites them to a picnic lunch, and then he mugs them and kills the toad. Everett and Delmar manage to get a ride to Everett's hometown in the back of a pickup truck when they see Pete working on a chain gang. They get to town, and Everett discovers that his wife, played by Holly Hunter, changed her last name and that of their daughters. Plus, she told the girls that he was dead, having been hit by a train. Everett gets into a rather one-sided fight with her fiancé, Vernon T. Waldrip, and they learn in a scene that I know we're going to talk about that Pete's chain gang is in town, so that night, they sneak into Pete's holding cell and they break him out. Pete reveals that the sirens dragged him away and turned him into the police, and it appears that the other two lucked out in leaving the area before they got back. Pete confesses that he gave away the treasure's location while under torture and threat of a lynching. Everett has a confession of his own, though. There is no treasure. He made it up because he knew his wife was getting remarried, and he needed to convince them to come along because they were all chained together. Pete is furious at this because he only had 2 weeks left on his original sentence, and now they've tacked on another 50 years for the escape. The three of them stumble upon a rally of the Ku Klux Klan who are preparing to hang Tommy. In an attempt to rescue him, they disguise themselves as Klansmen, but it turns out that Big Dan Teague is there and he exposes them. In all the chaos, we learn that the Grand Wizard of the Klan is none other than Homer Stokes, the gubernatorial candidate who is running against the incumbent governor and is apparently polling very well. Stokes is played by Wayne Duvall, and while I'm at it, I should mention that Governor Pappy O'Daniel is portrayed by Charles Durning. At any rate, they get Tommy out of there, and they cut the support wire for the burning cross, which comes crashing down on Big Dan. Everett talks the other three into helping him get his wife back. They disguise themselves with long beards, and they sneak into a Stokes campaign rally, supposedly as musicians. The group begins to play Man of Constant Sorrow, which gets a huge reaction. You see, during all their adventures, they had no idea that the song has been turning into a monster hit. Homer spots them and recognizes them as the ones who ruined his Klan meeting. The crowd doesn't care, and they literally run him out of town on a rail. Pappy O'Daniel jumps up on the stage and takes the politically expedient opportunity to both endorse the Soggy Bottom Boys and grant them full pardons. Everett's wife agrees to remarry him, but it has to be with the original ring, which she says is in a roll-top desk in the cabin in the valley that's about to become a lake, and where Everett originally said the treasure was buried. The next morning, they go to the cabin, and they discover that Cooley's crew is waiting for them, and they don't care that the governor gave them a pardon, which was broadcast on the radio all over the state. Cooley's going to hang them immediately. Everett, who until now appeared to be very skeptical of religion, drops to his knees and begins praying out loud. Suddenly, the valley is flooded, and they're saved. Tommy survived by clinging to, surprise, a roll-top desk, and they return to town. Unfortunately, when Everett gives the ring to his wife, it turns out to be the wrong ring. She doesn't want that one, and she can't quite remember where she put the real ring. And as they walk across the railroad tracks, we see the blind man on the handcart in the distance singing, "Bear me away on your snow-white wings to my celestial home."
Okay. We should mention real quick that Big Dan Teague is played by a member of the Coen Brothers stock company, John Goodman.
Oh, I did overlook that, didn't I?
Yes. Now, as I mentioned up top, this movie is loosely based on Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey, even though both Coen Brothers claimed that they never actually read it and only knew it from being referenced elsewhere. And that, as a matter of fact, Tim Blake Nelson, who was a college professor before he became an actor and also a director, was the only one on set who had actually read the entire poem. Now, the movie does have several references to the Odyssey. For example, Everett's first name, Ulysses, the blind seer, the one-eyed man, the fact that he is trying to find his wife,
named Penelope. You know,
and then, and a few other references. But there are also a lot of Americana references throughout the movie. You know, Claude's already brought up one of them, George Babyface Nelson. And then there's also Tommy Johnson's claim. By the way, Tommy Johnson is played by Chris Thomas King. He claims that he sold his soul to the devil in order to be able to play guitar. Now, that's part of a legend where either he or Robert Johnson was the one who sold their soul to the devil. There has been a movie about that as well, Crossroads, not the Britney Spears one. And then there is also the of Pappy O'Daniel, who was a real-life governor, just not of Mississippi.
Yeah.
And then
okay, go ahead.
And then, of course, because, or maybe in spite of, the fact that this title comes from Sullivan's Travels, that movie shares quite a few scenes or types of scenes with "Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?" There's a scene in a movie theater slash church.
Yes.
There's a chain gang that's a road movie, as I mentioned before, things like that. So there's all sorts of Americana in the movie in addition to the Odyssey references.
Yeah, I was also going to bring up that that there also seem to be echoes of other films in here, and I'm thinking specifically of the Klan scene with where they go. And typically when you see a movie that has a Klan scene, you will see lots and lots of extras all dressed in the white robes and chanting. But in this particular film, you see the Klans, like the Klansmen are marching and they're in this very intricate step kind of formation thing. And then you have these three guys who have to dress up as the Klansmen to make the rescue. And I was like, this is the Wizard of Oz. And I know that the Coen brothers like to play with the Wizard of Oz a lot.
Yes. And it's also shot almost like a Busby Berkeley number with some Lenny Riefen, with some Lenny Riefenstahl Triumph of the Will thrown in as well, I would say.
Where would you cite that?
Well, more in how when there's not an overhead shot, when they're marching, you know, I mean, it's just a little bit of it, but it's there,
okay,
I would say. Now, another part from the Odyssey that I forgot to mention is the sirens. Now, this movie is a comedy, of course, but it's also a musical, you know, because there are a lot of songs performed in the movie and there are a lot of musical sequences. And in fact, when the three convicts, Everett and Pete and
Delmar,
come across the woman, they are singing. Now, even though they are played by Christy Taylor, Mia Tate, and Musetta Vander, they were all dubbed in the singing. And they're singing, by the way, a song called "The Didn't Leave Nothing for the Baby." And they're being dubbed by Emmylou Harris, Alison Krauss, and Gillian Welch, who also shows up in a montage scene a little later in the movie where she goes to a music store to ask if there's any copies of Man of Constant Sorrow. And most of the lead actors or characters who actually sing in this movie are dubbed. For Clooney, this was a particular embarrassment. For those who don't know, his aunt was Rosemary Clooney, one of the more famous singers of the 40s and 50s. And so he was all gung-ho about getting to carry a tune here. But in the end, when his character is singing Man of Constant Sorrow, his voice is being dubbed by Dan Tominski, who also shows up as a mandolin player later in the movie. The only actor of the main characters who's singing in his own voice is Tim Blake Nelson. When Delmar is singing, he's in the jailhouse now. That is Tim Blake Nelson actually singing.
Yeah, and I had to wonder, because I know that Clooney did actually work pretty hard on doing Man of Constant Sorrow, and they ultimately wound up not using his voice. And I have to wonder if that was a function of, like, when they figured out that they were going to have to dub him, basically. Because here's the thing, is when Clooney is singing, okay, it's one of the few times where the it doesn't really quite match up. It's like, okay, you can tell it's not him singing. You know, typically, even when a singer is lip syncing to their own voice, and they're hearing playback in the studio and doing their thing, it's at least close. And with Clooney, it really doesn't work in either scene that you see him singing in. Okay, now in the radio station, he's got that, you know, that circular can microphone, and his mouth is largely covered up, but you can still kind of see that this just isn't working here. It's a lot more obvious in the scene toward the end when he's at the political rally, because his face is much more visible, and you know, you kind of wish that they would have depended a little bit more on longer shots to try and carry that off. So I kind of wonder whether he actually did do the singing with the expectation that this is going to appear in the film, and then later on they said, no, this just isn't going to work, and they dubbed it in, or if a decision was made and he just is not very good at lip syncing himself.
I think it was the former, because he really wanted to do it. And you have to remember, in musicals and even non-musicals of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even all the way up to the 60s, unless it was someone like Fred Astaire or Ginger Rogers or Gene Kelly doing the singing, dubbing people singing was a fairly common practice, you know, that they would, that the actor might look like they're singing, but someone else is doing the singing instead. For example, in another movie that Veronica Lake would appear in after this, This Gun for Hire, she plays a singer, and it's not her voice singing it. And this, as I said, this has been a thing that has been a long tradition in Hollywood movies, musicals or no. So while I'm sure Clooney was disappointed by this, you know, this is not, he was not the first one this happened to, nor would he be the last.
Sure. I mean, and I get it. I mean, you know, through the 60s, we listened to Marnie Nixon more than we did any other actress. So I get how that works. You know, the other lip syncing that doesn't work actually would be during In the Jailhouse Now, because we have John Turturro's character who has to come in and do that yodeling bit. And it wasn't until I was like watching the credits, I realized they gave credit to a yodeler. And I was like, okay, no wonder he wasn't very good at that, is they brought somebody else in to do that too.
Well, again, you know, because it's such a common practice, I wasn't as bothered by it as you were. Now, another piece of Americana that we should mention as well. This was the first of four movies to date, anyway, that Clooney has done with the Coen brothers. And he actually agreed to do this movie without reading the script first, because he was such a fan of them. And in each of the movies that he's done with them, he's played a fool, or at least a guy who thinks he's much smarter than he actually is. And here he's playing a certain type of character. If you asked him or the Coen brothers if they had actually made this movie in the 30s or maybe early 40s, who would have played this character instead? The answer would have been Clark Gable, because that's the source of Clooney's inflections and the speed at which he talks most of the time.
Yeah.
You see a lot of Gable in this performance.
Yeah, that absolutely. I get that. You know, it's kind of interesting, though, is early in the film, we find him saying, "Damn, we're in a tight spot," like several times. It's all the same scene. It's the scene with the barn's on fire. And I'm thinking, like, this is going to turn into like a catchphrase throughout the film, and that's it. We don't hear it again throughout the rest of the film, even though there are plenty of times when we could see him looking at what's going on and saying, "Damn, we're in a tight spot." But for whatever reason, that line just drops off the face of the earth.
Right.
But it becomes now, a little bit of a catchphrase for people who are not totally familiar with the film.
Right. Now, I should mention, getting back to Clooney working with the Coens, I am overall a fan of the Coen brothers as filmmakers. When I was compiling my top 10 lists year by year, they've made at least seven movies of their 18 of the 18 films that they've written and directed, or co-written in some cases, to date. That seven of their films have shown up on my top 10 lists. Now, the Clooney films, it's funny that each time I watch them, when I watch them for the first time, I'm always somewhat disappointed in them, because I'm expecting better things from what they could be. And it's only after a rewatch that I tend to like them a little more. And that's especially true on this one, because I thought when I first saw the movie that some of the caricatures that show up here, and the Coen brothers are big on caricatures
Oh, yeah.
in all of their comedies, That some of those caricatures were going a little bit too far. And it was only after watching it a second time that I learned to appreciate it a little more. And the other movie that they did with Clooney that I ran into that problem was Burn After Reading, which is their satiric look at spy movies. And again, the first time, you know, there were elements in it that I certainly loved, but there were also elements that turned me off. And I had to watch it again to really appreciate them.
So, yeah, I think there's a little bit of a, like some of their material just kind of has to grow on you a little bit, if that makes sense. And so, you know, the first time through is like, okay, this is all right. But there are going to be certain things that you like and certain things that you don't like. And then on repeated viewings, you start to appreciate it just a little bit more. And you realize that this is going a lot deeper than you initially suspected. And I got that with Fargo and with Raising Arizona. And yeah, as you mentioned, Burn After Reading, you know, that you really, you kind of need to like watch it and like percolate on it a little bit so that the next time around you get to appreciate it a little bit more. And I know at this point, like I watch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, for instance, and I'm going to be doing a deep dive for like the next week on roots music, for instance, you know, because you just, we mentioned it briefly at the beginning, is like just the soundtrack to this film is so great. It's so wonderful. And it's like, now I just want to listen to nothing but for the next several days.
And in fact, the soundtrack was
a huge,
bigger hit. Yeah, it was an even bigger hit than the film was.
Yeah.
It won a few Grammys as well. And it's an excellent soundtrack. And it's a mixture of actual old recordings from the time and of newer artists covering those older songs. And this is the first of three movies to date that the Coen brothers did with T-Bone Burnett as the music producer. He would also serve that function on their remake of True Grit and also for the folk music movie they did Inside Llewyn Davis, which I hope we'll be covering in a future episode. Although I have to say, getting back to what you were talking about here, I actually did like Raising Arizona and Fargo when I first saw them. Now, that's not to say that I didn't appreciate them more on further viewing, but I didn't have the same problems with those two movies initially that I did watching Oh Brother, Where Art Thou when I first saw it in the theater, because I was rip-roaring to see this. And then I thought, you know, there's good stuff here, but it doesn't quite work for me. Now, one element of the film that didn't work for me at the time that still doesn't work for me is, unfortunately, the character of Everett's wife, played by Holly Hunter. Now, I have to assume that she did this movie as a favor to the Coens, since they gave her one of her first big roles in Raising Arizona, because she's got nothing to work with whatsoever.
Yeah, I think you're right. She's a little bit thin, and she and there are certain character traits which are, I don't know, maybe assumed. It's like as though a scene had been cut out somewhere. And so like she makes the reference to counting to three a couple of times, and you're supposed to know what that means. And all you're getting from that is Everett's reaction to it, which, oh, I already counted to three. And we have no idea what that means. So I think that there's stuff missing that we just never got to see, or, whether it just wasn't written or it didn't make the final script or didn't make the final cut of the film. But yeah, she's not given a ton of stuff to do other than kind of be maybe a kind of obstacle, like one more hurdle for Everett to jump over. And now you're kind of wondering, why is he so drawn to her?
Well, I sort of assumed that counting to three was the usual thing. You know, I'm going to count to three, and if you don't do this, then we're done. So that's what I thought that was. But yeah,
I mean, I picked up that too. But my point being is that it's almost like, and I'm thinking of like Jimmy Stewart and the staircase in It's a Wonderful Life, where you, a couple of times you see him where he's going up the stairs and he accidentally takes the top of the baluster off and has to put it back in place. So that when he gets to the point first where he takes it off and he's getting ready to throw it out of rage, and then later on at the end of the movie where he accidentally pulls it off and he's just happy that it's happened and he's kissing it as he puts it back. You know, you've got something that establishes the activity, and we don't have that with I already counted to three, you know, because nobody says I already counted to three. You get stuff like I'm going to count to three, but that I already did it, not so much. And that's my point, is that there seems to be something that we just, that wasn't given to us. And not that it's terrible, because you can make the assumption, as you did, that, you know, this is part of what she does. But it kind of would have been nice to see her actually doing the counting to three, so that, what does she mean by that? Does she mean, I took the time to think about it? Or is there some other thing behind it?
Yeah. Now, one other oddity about this movie in the context of the rest of the Coen brothers' work, at least at the time, this along with Hudsucker Proxy, which also had Charles Durning in it, was arguably the least violent movie that the Coen brothers ever made, because along with their skewed comic sensibilities, which show up in all of their movies, even the really dark movies like The Man Who Wasn't There or No Country for Old Men, there usually is some sort of twisted humor going on there. But the Coen brothers are usually not ones to flinch away from the violence. Even in the second movie that Clooney did with them, Intolerable Cruelty, there's a quite memorable scene in which a hitman is dispatched that's pretty violent. But this one, along with Hudsucker Proxy, as I said, is probably and maybe A Serious Man is probably among the least violent movies that they ever did.
Well, maybe in this one, it's kind of implied, because when they're in the theater, it's a Ted Healy movie, which has the Three Stooges in it, but we don't see the Stooges, so it's just, okay, that kind of happened off screen. You come close to it, because during the Klan meeting, you think that that Big Dan, John Goodman's character, is going to lose that other eye. You know, we've got that flag that's coming straight down at him, and we don't realize until the point where his character catches the flag by its stick that's got a sharp point on the end of it. And so... You have that moment like, oh, this is going to get ugly. And then it doesn't, because he unexpectedly manages to just grab the thing out of midair.
Okay. So, and we should mention another member of the Coen Brothers stock company. Although sadly, as far as I can recall, he hasn't done anything with the Coen Brothers since this movie, John Turturro, who had appeared in Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, and does a very good job here, I believe. Oh, and in the Big Lebowski, of course, and does a very good job here as Pete. And although he would go on to make a spinoff of the Big Lebowski involving his character from that movie, he hasn't worked with the Coens since, I believe, which is too bad, because I think he's always good in their movies.
Yeah, he is. and you're right, it is a little bit of a shame.
So is there anything else you want to mention before we wrap this up?
Well, once again, it is a fun movie. I don't get to watch it very often, unfortunately, because my wife refuses to watch it with me. And there's a really dumb reason for that, and it actually involves a karaoke bar. So when I get to watch it, I have to watch it on my own or with somebody other than my wife. But it is fun to watch. And while this film doesn't necessarily have the Easter eggs the way that Sullivan's Travels did, there are a couple of like interesting details that you get to see in the backgrounds of this film if you watch a little bit closely, and or not even necessarily the background. And I'm thinking of, and I just thought it was a nice eye for detail, is there is a scene where Everett throws a newspaper into a campfire, okay, and the front page of the newspaper talks about how the valley is going to be flooded. So we know at least that part of his story wasn't a lie. But then what happens is as that page burns away, there's another page underneath that says something about the Soggy Bottom Boys being a great, very popular band, but nobody knows who they are. And I thought that was neat. It was like something you really had to be looking for if you're going to see it. And then the other thing that I kind of thought was kind of cute was the, and I don't remember the name, but very early in the film when they have escaped and they first jump on the train, and Everett approaches a couple of tramps who are already on the train, and he asks them if they know anything about the metallurgical arts and so forth. The tramps are leaning on flour bags, and the bags happen to be from the Governor's Flour Company.
Right. Now, I didn't catch that when I first saw this. Okay, so in addition to both Sullivan's Travels and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou being available on DVD that she should be able to get from your local library, Sullivan's Travels is available to stream on the Criterion channel if you subscribe, and on Tubi with ads. And then you can also rent or buy it from most of the other major streaming services like Amazon, Google Play, Apple TV, and so on. Whereas Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is not streaming specifically anywhere, but it's available to rent or buy from Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Yahoo, and most other streaming services.
Indeed. What do we got going on next time around?
Well, next time we are going to ask the question, what happens to spies when they are no longer working for their respective agencies, like the CIA, the KGB, or MI6, or something like that?
Do they stop drinking weak martinis?
Right. And we're going to be looking at two movies that answer that question in wildly different ways. Ronin, directed by John Frankenheimer, and Duplicity, written and directed by Tony Gilroy. And in addition to both movies being available on DVD, possibly at your local library, Ronin is available to stream on something called Fubo TV, as well as on Starz, DirecTV, and Starz if you happen to get Starz through Amazon Prime. And then it's also available to rent or purchase through most other streaming services, including Amazon Prime, whereas Duplicity is available to stream on Peacock, as well as Peacock Premium and Tubi, although with ads. And then it is also available to rent or buy through most of the other major streaming services.
Yes, indeed. Cool, cool, cool. And tell me, where can we find you on the web?
Well, my name is Sean Gallagher, and you can find me on Facebook. You can also email us with a question or comment through our email address, wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com.
Likewise, you can find the show on the Twitter machine at @words_moviespod. You can find me on Twitter at Claude Call, and you can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, which you will find at howgooditis.com.
Okay, so, and the show is also on, has a Twitter handle, correct?
Yes, at @words_moviespod.
Okay, so we will see you all next time.
Thanks for listening. Take us out, please, Rebecca.
This is your announcer, Rebecca Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Mophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Anchor.fm. If you want to support the show, go to anchor.fm/wordsandmovies and click on the support link. Who knows? Maybe they'll even kick a few bucks my way. Thanks for listening.